For NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR correspondents around the globe. I'm Douglas Roberts. On the podcast this week, Seeking Peace with the Taliban, a warning to Iran, a vote in Switzerland about minarets, and the inevitable politics of Israel's wine industry. If you can't beat them, get them to join you. That is an increasingly popular idea in Afghanistan among government and Western officials who are struggling with a worsening Taliban insurgency. As NPR's Philip Reeves reports, they've renewed an effort to win over low-level insurgents and split them from their leaders.
A rocket's just landed. It's dark and cold. A crowd gathers to inspect the damage. This is the center of Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. It's often said this city is the only place President Hamid Karzai's government actually governs. Even here, it's dangerous. The rocket smashed into the outside wall of the Serena. That's a luxury hotel used by foreign diplomats and other international officials. The hotel's been attacked several times before. It's barricaded, like a fort. Jan Aga, a shopkeeper, is spattered with other people's blood. The rocket injured two people. Aga tended to them until the ambulances arrived. 8 years have elapsed since the US and other forces invaded Afghanistan and overthrew the Taliban government. This year, those forces suffered more losses than at any time since the conflict began. Military measures have failed to stem a rising insurgency. So the Afghan government and its Western allies are exploring other ideas.
I sense that, you know, we have now reset some conditions.
General Graham Lamb is a close friend of General Stanley McChrystal, the American commander of US and Western forces in Afghanistan. Lamb was a top British commander in Iraq. There, he played a leading role in devising a program that led many thousands of Iraq's Sunni militants to stop fighting US forces. McChrystal's persuaded Lamb to abandon his retirement plans and to attempt the same feat in Afghanistan. Lamb says the two war zones are different.
In Iraq, I had fighters on both sides. I had Shia militia on one side and I had Sunni insurgents on the other. Here, one seems to have this rather crude analysis where people just talk about the Taliban as a single sort of entity, which, of course, is a complete misunderstanding of those forces that are placed against us.
Lamb stresses he's come to Afghanistan to assist Karzai and his government, and that they, the Afghans, are taking the lead in a new push to get militants to abandon the Taliban. A few days ago, in a somber ceremony, Karzai was sworn in for a second term. He appealed to militants to return home. Lamb says Karzai has long advocated reintegrating militants.
President Karzai, from the very first inauguration speech, when his first term, right through to now, he's been absolutely consistent. We have not listened and then worked out how we can actively support that intent.
When they go to war, governments use certain words to describe their enemies. They call them fanatics, terrorists, criminals, evil. When making peace, they must rehumanize their foes. That's what Lamb does when he talks about low-level Taliban fighters.
I think there are many who fight well for a bad cause, or for a misunderstanding, a misappreciation, some for a dollar, some because it's cool, some because it's an opportunity to feed a family. Some because actually they enjoy it. There's a range of complex reasons.
Lamb believes most Taliban militants are not driven by ideology. Some fight because they believe foreign forces have come to occupy their lands forever. Some fight because of personal grievances.
This was exactly the same case in Iraq. They had personal grievances where we had killed their family or their friends or their fathers or their brothers, whatever the case may be. What we needed to do was establish a point of dialogue.
Afghans have a term for insurgents. Words that Lamb particularly likes.
Upset brothers, and I think it's a very helpful term.
Upset brothers.
Upset brothers.
Some heavily bearded Afghan men are awaiting their lunch in a rundown mansion in Kabul. This is headquarters of Afghanistan's Peace and Reconciliation Commission. Haji Fazi Ahmed Talwak, a commission official, is by the men's side. These, says Talwak, are our upset brothers, gesturing at the men. And those, he says, are their guns. He points to a heap of well-worn Kalashnikovs stacked on a red oriental rug beneath the chandeliers, specially arranged for the cameras, alongside a large, dust-caked Soviet-era cannon. It's a 75mm, he says. Talwak says the men have just turned themselves in to the commission. He brings on a portly, middle-aged man who says his name is Nur Mohammed. Fiddling nervously with his worry beads, Nur claims he's a member of the Taliban. He says he's quit fighting because he's tired of it. The commission's paid him $100 to cover his transport costs and is going to find him work. But we didn't surrender for the money, Nur insists. I just don't want to see this country destroyed anymore. The commission claims it's processed 8,000 militants in the last few years. Many people are not at all convinced this is true. There are stories of Taliban surrendering one day and then changing their minds. On a wide, dusty street in Kabul, a cluster of armed guards stands watch outside a building. Inside sits Wakil Ahmed Motawakil. Motawakil was foreign minister when the Taliban was in power. He's one of the commission's greatest critics. It has very little authority, he says. He doesn't think right now many Taliban will agree to stop fighting.
I think the Taliban don't trust us. They think there is no willingness for peace. Everything happening now shows signs of war, like new troops coming and militias forming. This reduces the chance of reconciliation.
Motawakil doubts the militants will deal with an Afghan government widely seen as weak and corrupt. He thinks there's even less chance if the US goes ahead and sends in many more troops. The Taliban leadership's already rejected reconciliation. They won't talk to the Afghan government unless the international forces first withdraw. This hasn't dented General Lamb's determination to try to win over their foot soldiers.
There are 32, 34,000 villages in this country. 80% of the population live in the rural community. What we have to do is make sure that these young men who come out of the fight have the opportunity to improve their life. We look at literacy, we look at some of the skills training, we look at the opportunities that exist within the country.
Lamb says Afghan and US authorities won't talk to any Taliban directly linked to Al-Qaeda and international terrorism. But it seems they'll talk to just about everyone else.
On the fact that, and the phrase that is often used, you know, blood on their hands. You know, we've all got blood on our hands. And so therefore one needs to just get through that.
Philip Reeves, NPR News, Kabul.
Time is running out for Iran. That was the message this week from the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. The IAEA overwhelmingly adopted a resolution rebuking Iran for conducting its nuclear activities in secret and for ignoring UN Security Council resolutions demanding it suspend uranium enrichment. The answer from Iran? No. Thus putting Iran and the international community on a course of possible confrontation early next year. NPR's Mike Schuster has the story.
The stage was set for today's action by the IAEA when its director, Mohammad El-Baradei, addressed the agency's 35-nation Board of Governors yesterday. El-Baradei has been working hard behind the scenes to find a compromise with Iran on its nuclear activities and to elicit answers from Tehran on a variety of outstanding questions which point to possible clandestine nuclear weapons activities. El-Baradei used unusually blunt language to describe his efforts.
There has been no movement on remaining issues of concern, which need to be clarified for the agency to verify the exclusively peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program. It is now well over a year since the agency was last able to engage Iran in discussions about these outstanding issues. We have effectively reached a dead end.
Given the stalemate, most of the members of the IAEA were willing to join the U.S. and Europe in backing the censure of Iran. The resolution criticized Iran for the secret construction of a second uranium enrichment facility at Fordo, south of Tehran, whose existence was only revealed in September, and for ignoring three U.N. Security Council resolutions calling for Iran to suspend uranium enrichment. The resolution also expressed serious concern that Iran's behavior points to possible military dimensions in its nuclear program. Senior U.S. officials today welcomed the adoption of the resolution and were pleased that both Russia and China signed on. Both have close relations with Iran and have expressed a reluctance to take any action that would jeopardize those relations, especially additional sanctions. Today, senior U.S. officials pointed to the possibility of what they called serious consequences if Iran doesn't begin to cooperate fully with the IAEA by the end of the year. But the U.S. representative at the IAEA, Glyn Davies, emphasized the U.S. wants a diplomatic resolution of this problem.
The United States remains firmly committed to a peaceful resolution to international concerns over Iran's nuclear program.
Still, Davies added,
our patience and that of the international community is limited.
British Prime Minister Gordon Brown, referring to the IAEA action, had no qualms today, giving quite clear expression to that impatience.
This is a definitive answer from the whole of the world, a massive majority, 25-3, the world sending a signal to Iran that this is completely unacceptable, that we now know what their level of nuclear ambitions are, that they must desist from them. This is the strongest wording I've seen. The next stage will have to be sanctions if Iran does not, as it should, respond.
For its part, Iran remained defiant. Tehran's ambassador to the IAEA, Ali Asghar Soltania, rejected the resolution, adding that Iran would resist any pressure, resolutions, sanctions, and threats of military attack, although there were no such threats made today.
The answer to this resolution is definitely no. We are not going to suspend our enrichment activities. We are not going to suspend the completion of the Fordo nuclear enrichment activities.
And as if Iran's defiant stance needed any bolstering, it was revealed yesterday that the Iranian government has seized the Nobel Peace Prize medal awarded to human rights lawyer Shirin Ebadi in 2003. Ebadi kept it in a safety deposit box in Tehran, but it has now been confiscated by authorities there. That has prompted a formal protest from the government of Norway, which administers the prize. The director of the Nobel Institute, Geir Lundestad, said today those who award the prize are quite aware that it can expose the winners to some danger.
We hope that the fact that she did receive the prize will give her some sort of protection, because she's not the only one being persecuted. I mean, after the elections, we have seen a very significant increase even in political executions in Iran, so the situation is very serious.
Ebadi is currently in London, reluctant to return to Iran in the violent aftermath of last June's disputed presidential election. Ebadi's husband was arrested in the crackdown, and he has reportedly been severely beaten. Mike Schuster, NPR News.
Voters in Switzerland will decide in a referendum this coming Sunday whether to amend their constitution to ban the construction of minarets, those slender towers attached to most mosques that are traditionally used to make or broadcast the Muslim call to prayer. The ballot initiative is sponsored by the far-right Swiss People's Party. Its politicians claim the minaret symbolizes a politicized Islam. But opponents say the measure is a thinly veiled attack against the country's law-abiding Muslim citizens. Eleanor Beardsley went to Switzerland recently, and she sent this report.
For the last 30 years, the call to prayer has resonated 5 times a day at Geneva's mosque. The chant is not played from a loudspeaker attached to the minaret, but sung by a muezzin in an interior courtyard of the stately sandstone-colored mosque. Only 4 of Switzerland's 200 mosques even have minarets, and they aren't allowed to broadcast the call to prayer. That's why the ballot initiative to ban them has stunned Swiss Muslims.
The Muslims here have no problem with the Swiss population or with the Swiss government, so we are shocked.
That's Hafid Ouadiri, former spokesman of the Geneva Mosque, who today heads a Muslim interfaith community organization. He says Muslims consider themselves law-abiding citizens like everyone else and don't understand what they consider an attack on their faith.
It's not the minaret, it's the goal. The goal is Muslims and Islam, and this extreme party is using the Muslims and Islam to show that they are the protector of the Christian culture, the Christian religion. It's not even a problem between Muslims and Swiss. It's a Swiss problem. Every day we receive, you know, mail, and they send things like this, pictures, you know.
Opening some hate mail, Wardiri pulls out a cartoon drawing of a woman clad in a black burqa in front of a Swiss flag dotted with missile-shaped minarets. That same drawing looks out from posters all over the city, part of what Wardiri calls the Swiss People Party's scare campaign. He also suspects the party is behind the pranksters who recently blasted the call to prayer from car stereo speakers while riding through a quiet neighborhood at dawn. Switzerland's 400,000 Muslims make up about 5% of the country's population. Most of them are from the Balkans, not the Middle East, and a large majority are considered non-practicing. Churches, synagogues, and civic organizations have joined in to fight the initiative to ban minarets.
Sehr geehrte Damen und Herren. In der Schweiz leben Angehörige.
In a recent televised address, Swiss President Hans Rudolf Merz called for respect and human decency as he asked voters to reject the initiative. In Switzerland's capital of Bern, many say the debate is hurting the country's image abroad. And in this nation of watchmakers and traditional craftsmen, there is fear that it could endanger export industries. In the back of everyone's mind is the Danish cartoon scandal of 2 years ago, when the Muslim world boycotted the small Scandinavian country over its perceived anti-Islamic message. Inside the Swiss parliament, legislators are finalizing all the ballot initiatives that will be voted on Sunday. Oskar Freisinger is one of the leaders of the Swiss People's Party. He says he's not worried about a backlash because the minaret initiative is taking aim at political Islam, not religious Islam.
The minaret is a problem because it always has been used in the history of Islam to mark the political advance of an Islam which has not made the separation between church and state. It has not accepted the equality of women. I have not a problem with the Muslims which accept that our civil right is above the religious dogma, but we have to protect our civil society and to avoid an Islam which is not really compatible with our way of living.
Recent polls predict the Swiss will vote against the minaret initiative. Nevertheless, it has plunged the country into weeks of debate about religion, race, tolerance, and terrorism. Muslim community leader Wardiri says that debate has been hurtful. Whether the initiative passes or not, he says, Muslims won't feel as welcome as they once did in Switzerland. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley.
Coming up, controversy over Israel's wine industry.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Douglas Roberts. The wineries of Israel are beginning to get a reputation on the international scene. While the country hasn't been known in the past for its wines, many labels are gaining acclaim inside and outside Israel. But as with many things in that part of the world, there is controversy. NPR's Lourdes Garcia-Navarro reports many of the more successful Israeli vineyards are in occupied areas like the West Bank and the Golan Heights.
This is the reserve, and this is the premium.
It's packed at the Israeli wine trade show in Tel Aviv. The buzz has less to do, though, with the alcohol everyone has imbibed at the various winery kiosks and the sense of excitement over the wines themselves.
The revolution is here.
Daniel Rogov is Israel's foremost expert on wines from this region. He says the days of kosher wine, meaning bad wine, are over.
People all over the world have started to realize it. Nowadays, you'll find that people like Robert Parker, The Wine Spectator, Decanter Magazine, some of the best critics in the world, the most important critics in the world, are writing positively about Israeli wines.
There are now well over 200 wineries here, most of them boutique operations that began in the last few years. That burst of production, though, has come with little regulation, at least insofar as labeling is concerned. Even if wines are produced in areas like the occupied West Bank, the label on the bottle says Product of Israel. Rogov says he doesn't agree with the practice, but even he doesn't explicitly say if a wine was made on occupied land.
When I write about wineries, I always say where they're located. For example, I'll say this winery is located 3 miles from Hebron. I assume that the intelligent reader knows what that means and then can make his or her decision based on their personal politics. It's not for me as a critic to dictate to somebody what to drink or eat or do with regard to politics.
Still, he acknowledges,
is wine political? Damn right it is.
Yoram Cohen founded the Tanya Winery, named after one of his daughters, in the Ofra settlement near the West Bank city of Ramallah. His first few bottles were made for relatives and friends. Now his production has expanded, as have the accolades. The wine is labeled as a product of Israel, even though it's made in the Ofra settlement. Cohen says he has a right to call his wine Israeli, and the government allows it.
There is no place that is more Israeli than the place that I come from. It's the Jewish heartland. The fact that Arabs have lived there for the past few hundred years doesn't mean that it isn't Jewish, so of course it is Israeli wine.
Debbie Zion represents the Yordan label, which comes from the Golan Heights, an area which Israel captured from Syria in the 1967 war. Many of Israel's best wines are from the Golan.
Well, the thing is that we started basically from nothing, or from something which is really small, because the wine consumption in Israel per capita per year was about 2 liters, I think, 15 years ago. And today we are around 4.5, which is not a lot if you compare it to Australia or to the United States.
She says despite the low rate of wine consumption among Israelis, only a fraction of Israeli wine is exported.
We produce about 5 million bottles a year. Mostly goes to the local market, but we export also, and the United States is our biggest market. But basically, in terms of export, entire Israeli wine market, they export about 10 to 15%, not more. Israel has some problems with image, you know.
She says most of the people who live in the Golan are philosophical about the future. If returning the land means peace with Syria, she says most winemakers there would probably agree to leave. Many have already started sister wineries in the nearby Galilee in anticipation of a possible land deal.
Wine was made here thousands and thousands of years ago. We lost that history because Muslims had the control of this area for a long time. And we had to start all over again. We're not going to not use this area, so we produce wine as long as we can.
And it will be good wine at that, she says. Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR News.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Roberts.